The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Reminisce Magazine. The first article that I'd like to share with you today is from the pop culture section, and it's titled, Is There a Fake Doctor in the House? Operation Gives Surgery the Silly Treatment. John Spinello was a student at the University of Illinois in 1962 when one of his design professors set an interesting assignment, create a toy or a game. So I got this box together with the overcharged battery and the buzzer, and by golly, it worked, Spinello recalls in the 2017 film Operation, The Power of Play. Spinello showed his project to his godfather, a model maker at Marvin Glass & Associates. Chicago-based MGA devised some of the most successful games of the era, including Mousetrap, Time Bomb, Simon, Mystery Date, and Rock'em Sock'em Robots, under the inventive eye of founder Marvin Glass. Glass bought Spinello's concept for $500 and the promise of a job at graduation. Spinello didn't end up at MGA after graduating, but in 1965, his idea became Operation, one of the more unusual and enduring games of the 60s. By now, millions have performed surgery on the unfortunate Cavity Sam, whose spate of bizarre complaints such as water on the knee, butterflies in stomach, and bread basket make up his phanatomy. Spinello's original game was set in Death Valley, and the object was to guide a character to water. Players moved on an electric probe along a groove and into holes in a charged metal box. If the probe touched the sides of the groove or holes, it completed the circuit and a buzzer sounded. Marvin Glass sold the rights to the prototype to Milton Bradley, where a designer named Jim O'Connor suggested making the game board a surgery patient and the probe a pair of tweezers. After remaining virtually unchanged since its introduction, the game got an update in 2004 in the form of a new illness for Cavity Sam. Hasbro, which bought Milton Bradley in 1984, had fans choose the ailment, and Brain Freeze won with 54% of the vote. A 2013 game update, however, left fans pained. It featured a slimmed-down and younger Cavity Sam and wider openings that made it easier to remove game pieces. In a case of life imitating art, Andrew Goldstone, an ear, nose, and throat doctor at Johns Hopkins, created a device for thyroid operations that alerts surgeons if they cut too close to the vocal cords. It had to be my floating around in my subconscious, Goldstone told Mental Floss in 2015, referring to Operation's buzzer setup, but I didn't make the connection until later. His son made the link first. After Goldstone told him about the device, Alec Goldstone said, "You've reinvented Operation." Dr. Goldstone's invention was used when John Spinello's daughter Lisa had thyroid surgery. "Thanks, Dad," she says in the documentary about her father. "You saved my voice. Are you happy?" "Sometimes," Spinello quips. Spinello declared bankruptcy in 2008, which meant he couldn't afford $25,000 for oral surgery that he needed a few years later. His fellow game inventors, Peggy Brown and Tim Walsh, appealed to fans via a crowdfunding site and raised enough money to pay for Spinello's operation and some of his other bills. Hasbro contributed by purchasing Spinello's original Death Valley prototype. And the next article I'd like to read for you is from the Keepsakes section, and it's titled Bonkers for Bozo, Boyhood Hero Lives On with Cherished Collectibles. And this story is submitted by Robin Stone of Murfreesboro, Tennessee. During the spring of 1976, Bob Bell, who played Bozo the Clown in Chicago from 1959 to 1984, brought his show to Nashville as part of a national tour. At four, I was devoted to the red-haired TV clown. The term superfan wasn't in common use in the 1970s, but when it came to Bozo, that's definitely what I was. My family got tickets to the show's Nashville taping as a special treat for me. In the studio, producers set the kids in a separate section of the audience. I was with my sister Cindy, who was 10. The lights went down, the curtains parted, and there was my idol. I yelled his name over and over, then rushed the stage. Bozo! 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 Production immediately halted. Cindy heard the clown shout, "Somebody get this kid out of here!" The incident didn't dampen my enthusiasm for Bozo. I collected a lot of Bozo the Clown merchandise over the years. Once I outgrew my fascination for it, I began selling it off at my mom's yard sales. Fortunately, Mom packed away two Bozo towels, so I'd have some tokens of my childhood obsession. We found them in 2014 in a keepsake box. They're a fun reminder of that day in Nashville and of growing up in the 1970s. Bozo definitely was an important part of kids' culture in that era. And our next article is submitted by Jacqueline Page D'Amato of San Francisco, California, and this is in the Brush with Fame section, and it's titled Running with the Best. Her father befriended track legend Jesse Owens. My father, Chester E. Page, did a lot of track and field in his teens and early 20s and won several trophies. He met and became friends with Jesse Owens. In the early 1930s, when I was a toddler, my father invited Owens to a sporting event in Salem, Oregon, where we were living. I treasure a picture taken around that time of Owens with my dad and my mom, Evelyn. My father liked to show off his prowess by jumping over our car while it was parked at the beach. I inherited some of his track talent. I was a fast runner as a teenager. Uncle Raymond, Dad's brother, decided that I should compete in the pre-Olympic trials, despite my being a smoker and having no training. Dad wanted nothing to do with the endeavor. I managed to come in second in the heats, which were run on a straightaway, and qualified for the 200-meter finals. When he heard that, Dad showed up to see my race. I was in the outside lane and took off feeling confident, but as we headed into the curve, I suddenly found myself in last place. I was so embarrassed that I ran completely off the track and hid behind the popcorn stand while the other runners passed the bleachers where my dad was sitting. I never lived that down. At least Dad didn't invite Owens to that event. Sadly, I have no memory of meeting Owens as a child, but my parents always remembered him as friendly and down to earth. And here are some facts about Jesse Owens, who lived from 1913 to 1980. He was born James Cleveland Owens in Alabama and called J.C. When his family moved to Ohio, a teacher misheard it as Jesse, and the name stuck. At the Big Ten Track Championships in 1935, Owens set three world records and tied a fourth, all in 45 minutes. Owens was the star of the 1936 Berlin Olympics, winning gold in the 100 and 200-meter races, long jump, and 4x100-meter relay. President Gerald Ford awarded him the Medal of Freedom in 1976. My next couple of articles are from a section titled Dear Diary, Pages from My Teenage Years. The first story is submitted by Frances Ann Smith of Tiffin, Ohio, and it's titled Standing Tall, Gaining Her Sea Legs in Seventh Grade. Most kids start kindergarten at 5. However, I started at 4, thanks to Dr. Wolf telling Mama, "Send her now, she's tall." As a lean-limbed 11-year-old in 7th grade, I had oodles of little girl words to spill into my dear diary that school year. That was 1961 to 62. Since my birthday was in December, a new diary for the coming year was the perfect present. I wanted it to have an air of sophistication, so I went for the soft vinyl cover in feminine colors. My favorite was Aqua, with a drawing of a teenage girl with a ponytail talking on the phone. Puffy pink hearts floated above her, and I envisioned her having lots to write about. On the first page, I decorated my signature with pizzazz. I pasted my school picture on the inside cover and added a list of my favorites: teacher, singer, record, magazine, and movie. Most diaries came with a flimsy lock and two equally flimsy golden keys. The lock warned, "No peeking. Personal. Stay out." I squirreled my book away in the headboard of my bed, which had a shelf with a secret compartment. My diary was a nosy Parker's paradise, and I often had an inkling that someone was snooping. Someone knew Hugh as Donna to slow dance, not me. Daddy was too busy working to be a Batinsky. That left one person, Mama. To trick her, I'd write, "Mama sure is crabby today," or even, "Mama likes to be nosy." If she gave me the cold shoulder after that, I had my answer. Knowing her habit of sneaking a peek at my diary kept me from writing any ultra-juicy secrets involving boy situations. Reading my old diary sometimes makes me cringe, but I also feel sympathy. I want to hug this poor, long-legged, skinny kid who was trying to muddle through the angst of seventh grade. From September 6, I wrote, "When I changed for gym, Glenna saw my undershirt and laughed and said real loud, 'You don't wear a bra yet. Mama has to buy me a bra before my next gym class.'" On October 3, I wrote, "I want to get braces. My vampire teeth bug me." At least learning to cook at Ross Junior High School was fun. On November 8, I wrote, "We broiled cinnamon toast in home ec." My most frequent entry, "I got a dime cone dipped at Dairy Queen after school." Our diaries were dear to us, and we took them seriously. Once after school, I was checking out the newest display of diaries at Woolworth's when I overheard a cheeky little miss tell her brother, "Now, these are not for boys, only girls. They're diarrheas." My diary helped me get through a confusing year, and thankfully, I did get braces. And the next story about her diary is submitted from Christy Ricketts of Gonzales, Louisiana, and it's titled Beatles, Bonnie Dresses, and Basketball. Looking back on my diaries from 1966 to 1970, I found myself yearning for those years with my family and friends. But the boys, oh my goodness, so many times reading the pages, I wonder, what were you thinking? In 1964, my 11-year-old self discovered the Beatles. Over the next 8 years, I wrote about everything, personal and historical. I lived in the small town of Hohenwald, Tennessee, and I loved family, school, books, movies, the Beach Boys, and basketball. On July 11, 1968, I wrote, "Today was wonderful. I got my contact lenses, and I am adjusting to them very nicely. They're tinted blue. I'm learning real quick how to put them in and take them out. You have to get the hang of it." Mother and I went to 100 Oaks Shopping Center, and I bought me a beautiful Bonnie-type dress, and I got a pair of lovely navy blue shoes and a book, The True Story of Bonnie and Clyde. I worked for 3 weeks so I could buy all this stuff. How about that? And on October 16, 1970, I wrote, "I was elected homecoming queen, 1970. Really, I can't believe it. I am so very happy. It makes you feel weak and humble to think of the wonderful friends who voted for you. I want to cry." And our next story about her diary is submitted from Glenda Ferguson of Powley, Indiana, and it's titled Locked and Loaded with Secrets. From the first entry, January 1, 1966, I locked my diary every day, but my brother Mike knew I kept the key in my jewelry box. I didn't catch on that he and his friend had been reading my diary until he mentioned my secret crush. I was so embarrassed, and the tears, oh my. Reading them now, I'm not sure why I felt it was necessary to keep those thoughts locked up. He was looking at me. I went to the local hangout, and he was there. If only I could move my desk and sit beside him. My next story to share with you is titled The Sound of Success, and this is written by Randall Hill. Two 16-year-olds calling themselves Tom and Jerry recorded a single in 1957, Hey Schoolgirl, an Everly Brothers-influenced ditty. The Queens' New York buddies enjoyed transitory stardom from the minor hit, which made it to the middle of the Billboard charts. For the next several years, the musicians tried to duplicate that first effort without success. And then in early 1964, the pair reappeared with a new sound and using their real names, Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel. As Columbia Records artists, Simon and Garfunkel recorded their debut album, Wednesday Morning, 3 a.m., an acoustic work of Simon originals, folk songs, and traditional tunes. Released that October, the LP sold 2,000 copies, a victim of that year's Beatlemania. Simon and Garfunkel went their separate ways for a while. One of the album's tracks was The Sounds of Silence, later The Sound of Silence, a tune Simon had composed in 1963 while still living with his parents. I used to go off in the bathroom because the bathroom had tiles, so it was a slight echo chamber, he said. I'd play in the dark. Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. A powerful social statement, the song warned against alienation and indifference toward others. And as anti-war sentiments grew, many heard the lyrics as a call to unity. Without telling the musicians, Columbia Records producer Tom Wilson added drums and electric guitars to the song, creating a haunting folk rock single with top 40 appeal. Released in October 1965, the 45 rocketed to number one in the months following, heralding a coming stardom that the friends had only dreamed about. From the front and center section, I have another musical article for you, and this is about James Brown, who lived from 1933 to 2006. He was one of the most influential performers of the 20th century. The hardest working man in show business was at the peak of his popularity in the 1960s. The chart-topping Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, released in 1965, even launched a new genre, funk. Known as the Godfather of Soul, Brown also influenced modern R&B and hip-hop, and his energetic shows and vocal pyrotechnics, he had an uncanny ability to scream on pitch, inspired Michael Jackson, David Bowie, Mick Jagger, and Prince to find their own groove. He was born in a shack in the woods in South Carolina. When his parents split up, he was sent at age four to live with an aunt who ran a brothel in Georgia. His childhood was one of extreme poverty. His school once sent him home for having insufficient clothes. As a star, he reveled in flashy clothing and jewelry. Neighbors and church services influenced him. Friends taught him to play piano, guitar, and drums. He learned gospel music and some of his dramatic stage moves, such as dropping flat to his knees at tent revivals. Brown's 1959 Try Me was his first single to hit the charts. Over the next 27 years, he'd be a regular fixture there with almost 100 singles and nearly 50 albums on the charts. His label wouldn't finance a live album, so Brown did it himself. Live at the Apollo, one of the first live concert LPs, was a smash, staying on the charts for an astounding 66 weeks. During the riots of the late 1960s, Brown appealed for nonviolence. In 1968, he told activist H. Rapp Brown, "I'm not going to tell anybody to pick up a gun." He used his status to raise money for civil rights causes. Brown sometimes canceled his own shows to stage benefit concerts for groups working for black civil rights. He urged kids to stay in school. A seventh-grade dropout, Brown recorded Don't Be a Dropout in 1966. His will included provisions to establish an educational trust for needy children. Harry James Ford of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, submits an article for the Growing Up section titled Playtime Was Work Time. During the 1940s, I lived the first 7 years of my childhood on the south side of Pittsburgh. One of my favorite ways to enjoy myself was to play working hard. I observed the hard-working men in my African-American family, and I wanted to be like them. Our house was on Carson Street, close to the Jones and Laughlin Steel Company mill, and very near the railroad tracks. The rough, grassy area near the track bed was peppered with rocks and occasionally chips and lumps of coal that fell off uncovered train cars heading to the mill. This busy, if dreary, industrial environment was my place of work. I had to straighten it up. I asked my wonderful grandmother to pack me a lunch, as she faithfully did each morning for the men in the family. My lunch usually would consist of a sandwich sliced diagonally and maybe a cookie or a piece of fruit, each wrapped neatly in waxed paper and packed in a brown paper bag. I also would carry to work an ash shovel and an old galvanized bucket. Then off I went, walking with determination to meet and conquer my challenges of the day. I would dig dirt and gather rocks, making neat piles. I also collected wood scraps for kindling and bits of coal chips or lumps for our kitchen stove. After working what I called my shift for a while, I would break for lunch. Then it was back to work to finish my busy day. Eventually, tired and soiled, I walked home feeling very pleased with myself. Climbing the old wooden back steps of our time-worn house, I entered our second-floor kitchen. There, with sincere pride, I proclaimed, "I'm home! I'm home!" From At Work section, Jenny Howard from Lake City, Florida, submits an article titled, "Extra Training Unlocks the Job." We lived on the poor side of town in East Moline, Illinois. Dad was often out of work, but my mother did the best she could with the little money he earned. Eventually, Dad started his own trash collecting business, which earned a decent income. At United Township High School, I took my first key punch class, which I loved. After graduating, I took a 6-week course and earned a key punch certificate. Two large farm equipment companies were important employers in the area. I first applied at International Harvester Company, where the interviewer laughed and told me to come back when I had experience. I found out through the grapevine that John Deere needed a key punch operator in the accounting department. I put on my best dress and went to meet with James Downing, the head of the department. During the interview, he asked me what my father's profession was. I hesitated, embarrassed to say my father picked up trash. After I told him, he politely proceeded, and then, lo and behold, he said, "Welcome to the accounting department." There was another hurdle. Signing the paperwork for the position, I saw that employees had to be at least 18. My birthday was 2 weeks away. Jim consulted with someone in the employment department and told me they'd hold the position. True to their word, on my birthday in September 1968, they called and asked if I still wanted the job. And that wasn't all. In my interview, Jim had learned that I didn't have a car and would have to take cabs and the bus to and from work. Jim arranged for me to carpool with a coworker. I paid the driver each week until I saved enough to buy a car. I held various positions in my 30-year career at John Deere and retired in 2000. I never forgot that it was possible because one man gave a shy girl a chance. And our next article is from the True Love section titled "Make Hay While the Sun Shines," and it's submitted by Ray Arnhold of Tacoma, Washington. Uncle Joe and Aunt Florence's hay crop on their farm in Lamoille, Nevada, was ready to harvest in 1954. Stationed at McCord Air Force Base in Tacoma, I took furlough to help. In late July, I was mowing hay when Florence's sister, my Aunt Ruby Catherine, called RC, and her husband Jim arrived from McKilteo, Washington, for a visit. With them was a good-looking young woman I'd never met. They introduced me to Evelyn, their children's babysitter. Evelyn had come with them because they didn't want to lose her to another family. In hindsight, they should not have brought her along if they wanted to keep her. After dinner, my cousin Helen and I planned to go to a drive-in movie, and we invited Evelyn. Soon, Evelyn and I were taking evening drives, talking about all kinds of things, including finally deciding to get married when we got back to Washington, which was soon. My furlough would end in a few days. Before I left on my furlough, I had plans to return to college, but when I got back to McCord, I re-enlisted for 6 years, a move that provided us with a regular paycheck as well as a $1,000 bonus. Evelyn's dad suggested we put off our marriage long enough to plan a church wedding. He'd been buying wedding presents for relatives and friends for a long time, he said, and it was about time he got some in return. We agreed this was a good idea. We gave it 2 weeks. In that time, Evelyn and her mother sent out invitations, bought a wedding dress, and made all arrangements. I don't know how they did it. At our wedding on August 28, 1954, we had more than 100 guests and got a carload of gifts. I rented a house near McCord and, as a wedding gift, gave Evelyn a fishing rod and reel. From our time capsule, the year is 1965, and here are some things that were popular that year. Doo-wop. Vocal groups who sing in harmony and use the nonsense syllables that give this music genre its name include The Temptations, who release My Girl. Convenience store. Quick Trip and Quick Shop opened their first locations, adding to the trend of small stores designed for speedy grocery runs, especially outside traditional hours. Empty nest syndrome. As birth rates decline and families move more, some parents feel let down when the kids move out. Flash Cube. Kodak adapts some of its cameras for this cheap add-on that lets photographers squeeze off 4 flash shots in a row. Hippie. A movement flowers among young people who reject the Vietnam War and resist authority and tradition. Kiwi fruit. Growers in California established vineyards of the Chinese gooseberry, which is renamed for the country that exported it, New Zealand. Pop art. Young artists use commercial objects such as soup cans and later celebrities in their provocative work. Skybox. Luxury enclosures for select patrons. High above the nosebleed seats are just one of the sports stadium first at the state-of-the-art Houston Astrodome. We've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reminisce is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. Again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.